Save big on your landscaping project now at Menards. Whether you're installing a patio or a new retaining wall, Menards has the blocks you need to get the job done right. We carry the largest in-stock selection ready to take home today. Stop in and get our 12-inch smooth patio block on sale now. Save big on concrete landscape blocks at Menards. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big.
The following program is a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcast Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com to learn more about this and our other weekly storytelling programs and become a patron today to show your support and get instant access to our extensive archive of downloadable ad-free tales of terror. Thank you for listening. And enjoy the show.
Disclaimer. Horror Hill is a horror anthology podcast bringing you scary stories from all corners of the internet and beyond. As such, certain stories include content that some listeners might find offensive. Listener discretion is advised. Hello there, listeners, and welcome back to Horror Hill. As always, I'm your host, Eric Peabody, and after our two-episode foray into the world of Dale and Earl, I figured it would balance things out nicely to feature a couple of shorter stories this week. These two are lean, mean, and have a certain je ne sais quoi that reminds me of old Tales from the Crypt episodes. We'll begin with Beneath the Hives by Micah Edwards. In this story, Silas is a new employee at a large apiary. The owner, Adam Fenning, is a genius with bees, even if he is a little odd. Silas slowly becomes accustomed to Adam's eccentric demands, such as having Silas talk to the bees as he goes about his day. But as time goes on, Silas begins to suspect that there's some other secret to Adam's successful honey business, and in this case, his curiosity might just get him stung. Following that, we'll crack into The Thing Living in Mr. Crabtree's Nose by Charles Williams. This is a tale about Dr. Aldo Ravelli, a dentist that loves his job. Well, to be more accurate, what Aldo loves about his work is the unrestricted access to nitrous oxide and the privilege and financial leeway it offers. Aldo is just returning to work today following a stint in rehab, and he could really use a nice, gentle segue back into the world of sober dentistry. Unfortunately, his first patient is an elderly gentleman named Mr. Crabtree, and Mr. Crabtree happens to have quite the surprise up his sleeve. Joining me tonight for our second tale is Arissa Montañez, who is providing her lovely voice for the role of Mary. You're listening to the standard edition of this program. If you'd like to help support Horror Hill and also remove these pesky ads, head to chillingtalesfordarknights.com and click Patrons in the upper menu to sign up today. You'll get instant access to hundreds of ad-free stories, and we can scale back some of our less savory means of generating money for the show. By the way, You wouldn't happen to still have all of your organs, would you? And now, from author Micah Edwards, I give you Beneath the Hives. This is Silas. Silas, come introduce yourself. Silas had heard that beekeepers often talked to their bees. It hadn't seemed particularly strange, as a concept. He'd imagined it as more of a running monologue, though, the same way people might talk to their cattle or plants or anything. Heck, folks talk to themselves with nothing at all around to hear. So sure, why not talk to bees? This wasn't what he had expected, though. Adam Fenning, his new employer and the man behind the wildly successful Fenning Honey Empire, was clearly waiting for Silas to strike up a conversation with the bees. Silas hesitated uncertainly, wondering if it was a joke or some sort of test, but when Adam gestured with growing impatience, he stepped forward and leaned down to the nearest hive. Hello, I'm Silas. He felt ridiculous. Nice to meet you. There was no response from the hive, of course. Nevertheless, Adam motioned to the rest of the boxes. On down the rows. It's important that they all know who you are. Silas felt fairly certain that knowing who he was not, in fact, important to the bees. Even if they could understand him, he imagined that they wouldn't particularly care. They had their fields full of clover and other flowering plants. They had their sturdy, protected hives. They seemed very unlikely to care who it was that drained and bottled the honey they made. On the other hand, Adam appeared to care quite a lot, and Silas wasn't about to poison the relationship with his new boss on his very first day. He dutifully made his way up and down the wide rows, gently introducing himself to each hive in turn. The bees buzzed past him with an utter lack of concern. As Silas said his final hellos and was about to turn back toward Adam, he noticed one more hive sitting a significant distance away from the others. He looked questioningly at Adam, who shook his head. That one's new and still adjusting. Leave them alone until I bring them over to join the rows. Silas had never heard of having to keep bees separate from each other until they adjusted, but it was clear that Adam did things his own way. He wasn't here to judge, just to work. Good, said Adam. Now, I know this may look silly to you, but it's a key bit of keeping the hives happy. I get almost double the output from my hives as anyone else, and that's because I treat my bees as equals. As long as you're working here, you're to do the same. These are your co-workers, and I expect you to acknowledge them as such. Crazy, thought Silas as he nodded. You can think I'm crazy if you want. Don't shake your head, I know you're thinking it. I don't much care. You can believe what you like, same as I can. But as long as I'm signing your paychecks, you'll do what I say. Understood?
Understood.
Good. I promise not to be unreasonable about that. I'm giving you my expectations up front, so if you want to back out, you can do it right now without wasting any more of either of our time.
No, I'm fine with this.
All right. You all hear that?
Adam raised his voice slightly to better carry to all of the hives.
Silas is sticking around. You show him some respect.
It might have been his imagination, but Silas swore he heard a dip in the omnipresent buzzing, almost like a single-syllable reply.
Adam nodded, apparently satisfied with this exchange. Good. Now come on so I can show you the more industrial side of things. Harvesting isn't easy, clean, or pretty. You'll come to hate honey before you learn to love it again.
After 2 weeks on the job, Silas was beginning to agree with Adam's assessment. He'd been hired right before the first harvest of the year, and his days had been spent hauling heavily laden frames free from the hives, cranking the extractor, and moving pallets of full jars from place to place as they were cleaned, sealed, labeled, and packed for shipping. Despite the gloves and suit, At the end of the day, his hands were always faintly sticky, and the smell of honey never left him. Still, he was proud of the work he'd accomplished, and said as much to Adam when he picked up his first paycheck.
"Mm-hmm, you're doing well," Adam agreed. "The bees say you're a bit standoffish, though."
"They... what?" Silas had not expected this angle of conversation.
"They don't know much about you. Look, you're doing a fine job. You show up on time, you work hard, and you've been very polite to the bees. But you don't talk to them."
"I do. I say hello every day to every hive I'm working with."
"Sure, of course. But if I said hello to you when you showed up here and then not another word for the rest of the day, we wouldn't really be talking, would we? And you certainly wouldn't have any idea who I was. I'd just be some fellow you were working with. There'd be no connection."
"Well, the bees are hardly keeping up their end of the conversation," Silas said in an attempt at levity.
"They do, once you know how to listen. This isn't a big criticism, though it could be if you aren't willing to hear it. All I'm saying is that the bees are curious. That's a good thing. It means they like you. Tell them a bit more about yourself."
"Like what?"
"Anything. Co-workers, like I said. You don't have to have a deep relationship. They just want to know if your weekend went well, if you're having a good day."
Silas sought for a question that would express his utter confusion. Failing to find it, he settled on, "Why would they care?"
"Why do any of us care about each other? We like the connection. The bees tell you how they're doing. You know if they're happy or not. You know what they've been doing, where they've been, all about the health of the hives. But all they see of you is a man in a shapeless protective suit. They want more."
Adam never wore a beekeeping suit, Silas knew. He was far from comfortable with the idea of going among the bees without protective gear himself.
I want to have a good relationship with the bees, but I'm not interested in going to the hospital over it."
Adam waved his hand dismissively.
"I'm not asking you to take off the suit. They're used to people in suits. All of my helpers have worn them. Just talk to them. Tell them how you've been doing, what you get up to when you're not at the farm. I know you think it's crazy, but trust me, they're interested."
"I'll do it," Silas promised. He couldn't see another way out of this conversation. The check cashed just fine, and Adam paid significantly better than any other job around. Silas figured he could put up with the eccentricity in exchange for 40% higher pay. Like Adam had said, as long as he was signing the checks, he got to make the rules, even if they were crazy ones like let the bees in on your personal life. Silas checked carefully for cameras the next time he was at work, though. Probably, Adam was just superstitious and a little bit crazy, but it was still worth making sure that he wasn't spying. He didn't find anything, though, so he shrugged and told the bees about his weekend. Not that there was a lot to tell, as he'd mainly spent it tinkering with the car he was fixing up, but that was still more than the bees had done. The bees did seem to cluster around a bit more thickly when he was talking. Probably it had something to do with the vibrations of his voice or something. Obviously, they weren't actually listening, but it was possible that there actually was merit to Adam's theory about talking to them, after all. Over the next few months, Silas's awkwardness about talking to the bees faded away. On the day that Adam brought the distant hive over to join the Rose, Silas greeted them as he would have any new co-worker, welcoming them to the team. He found himself looking forward to the daily talks with the bees, one-sided though they were. In fairness, as Adam had pointed out, the bees did tell him all about themselves as well, through their movements, the behavior of the swarm, even the pitch of the ever-present buzz. They said plenty. They simply didn't use words.
Save big on your landscaping project now at Menards. Whether you're installing a patio or a new retaining wall, Menards has the blocks you need to get the job done right. We carry the largest in-stock selection ready to take home today. Stop in and get our 12-inch smooth patio block on sale now. Save big on concrete landscape blocks at Menards. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money at Menards.
After the initial rush of the honey harvest, Silas's duties had broadened somewhat. There was a lot more to beekeeping than simply taking the honey, and though the bees did all of the direct work, Silas found himself busy with keeping the plants healthy and free of weeds, ordering supplies for the second harvest that Adam swore they'd have by the end of the fall, and inspecting the hives for signs of illness or invasion. It was during this last duty that he noticed something strange that had escaped his attention before. All of the hives were a foot or so taller than they needed to be. The frames in the bottom brood box appeared to reach to the floor inside, but upon closer inspection, it was a false bottom with holes large enough for the bees to wriggle through. When Silas rapped on the wood with his knuckles, it made a hollow sound, but he could see no way to lift it up or get to the bottom of the compartment. He barely had a chance to investigate it, as the bees attacked him as soon as he began to poke at the thin floor of their hive. They couldn't sting him through his suit, but their agitation was clear. Silas replaced the frames and backed away. He went a few rows over and tried another hive, but he had no sooner placed his hand on the bottom than the bees began to swarm. Still, it was enough to confirm that the structure was the same. There was a second level beneath the frames that he was unable to access. Silas intended to ask Adam about it the next time he had a chance. To his surprise, Adam brought it up first. "Leave the base of the hives alone," he told Silas that evening before he left the farm. "The queens like to go deep and to be left in peace. Don't bother them."
"But the holes aren't nearly big enough for a queen bee," objected Silas. "She can't be in there. How would any of them be laying eggs?"
"The workers move them."
"But
I said to leave them be. They don't like you messing with that part of the hive. They made that pretty clear today, I think."
"Sure, but in the winter..."
"The bees and I will worry about the winter. They told you to leave it alone. And now I'm telling you the same. Understood?"
"Understood." The more Silas thought about it, though, the less he did understand it. Excluding the queen from the brood boxes didn't make any sense. It just wasn't how hives worked. Something else was going on in the base of the structures, something that had nothing to do with normal hive functioning. The following morning, the bees seemed more wary than usual when Silas greeted them. He told himself he was imagining things and continued about his daily routine. By the afternoon, they were reacting just as they always had, which was to say, mainly ignoring him as he went about his chores. There did seem to be a few more drones around the hives any time he drew close, but when he showed no inclination to disturb the bottom of the hives, they left him alone. He talked with them like normal, sharing information about his previous evening. When Adam spoke with Silas as he left, he said nothing more than, "Good work today." At home that night, Silas mused on the fact that Adam always seemed to know what he'd been saying or doing to the hives. He'd looked for cameras and recording equipment before and never found any. But this new discovery of spaces beneath the hives opened up new possibilities. Was it possible that Adam was hiding recording devices under his bees? If so, what for? And how had he gotten the bees to defend them? Silas continued to mull over the possibilities during the next few weeks. Slowly, he came to the conclusion that Adam was concealing some sort of equipment that pushed the bees to work harder. Silas had seen how they gathered around when he spoke. If that was a reaction to the resonance of his voice, then that might be a clue to what Adam was doing. Perhaps rigging the bees with some sort of subsonic speaker system could alter their behavior, force them to make more honey.
Silas knew he was speculating wildly. Whatever the actual technique involved, though, it was obvious that the sealed bottom portion of the hive was the key to Adam's success. That meant that he needed to get in there at some point to find out what was going on. He liked working for Adam well enough, but like Adam himself had said, as long as he was signing the paychecks, Silas had to follow his rules and his whims. If he ever wanted to stop being beholden to other people, he was going to need to strike out on his own at some point. Cracking the secret to Adam's success would certainly help on that front. Of course, there were two major obstacles to that: the drones and Adam. Thanks to the bee suit, the first wasn't a major issue. The bees could buzz angrily at him all that they wanted, but they couldn't do anything to stop him as long as he was safely sealed up. Adam was a much larger problem. Whatever he had stashed in the hives was alerting him to Silas's activities, and although so far he'd always waited until the end of the day to address it, there was no reason to believe he wasn't getting real-time updates. If Silas started prying off the bottom of a hive, he might find himself fired and forcibly removed from the farm before he could even see what was concealed underneath. The desire to find out what Adam was hiding ate at Silas. He told himself to be patient, to wait until an opportunity presented itself, but every day spent talking to the hives felt like another day that Adam was winning. He had to know what was under there. It was all he could think about as he went about his daily tasks on the farm. It occupied his mind in the evenings. He even began to dream about it. Over and over, he saw himself ripping that thin wooden plate free to reveal the truth beneath. The dreams never showed him the same contents twice. Sometimes it was something simple: gold, silver, or bundles of bills. Other times it was machinery or wires or tubes, complex and indecipherable. One time, an endless black cloud billowed out, engulfing him as he ran. Another time, he found himself blinking down at his own surprised face, an entire mirrored universe trapped beneath the plywood layer. Every morning, he woke up dissatisfied and just a little more anxious to discover what the hives actually contained. Fall was marching to a close, and Adam had suggested that he might not need or want Silas's help to winter the hives. He was running out of time. Finally, the opportunity came. Adam waved Silas over one morning as he arrived. "Think you can fend without me for a week? Distributor's trying to renegotiate our contract, and he's about to find out that I'm better at it than he is. It'll take a few days, though, and I want to see him squirm in person."
"Unless you're taking the bees with you, I can't see how it'll change my job much."
Silas kept his tone light, but inwardly, he was celebrating. At last, his long wait would finally be rewarded. Even if whatever Adam had in the box still let him know that Silas was breaking in, he'd be much too far away to stop it. By the time he returned from the negotiations, Silas would be long gone. The day after Adam left, Silas spent the morning going over the hives with extra care, looking for any pests, fungi, or mold. Now that the moment was here, he felt oddly guilty about what he was going to do. The bees had made it clear that they didn't want him in the hidden compartment. He was violating their faith in him. Adam had been equally clear, of course, yet, oddly, that barely bothered Silas at all. He told himself it was because the bees didn't have any say in the matter, while Adam was the one who had set it up. He couldn't shake the nagging thought that it was because he had grown closer to the bees. Over the last few months, they'd become friends. He pushed that thought down. They were insects that were unwittingly hiding a secret, one which he very much wanted to know. He wasn't going to hurt them. He was just going to find out what it was that Adam didn't want him to see. Silas's mind whirled as he approached the nearest hive and began to take out the frames. The bees buzzed angrily around him, battering futilely against his protective gear as he exposed the false bottom and felt around for a latch, a button, any sort of release at all. As before, he found none, but this time he was determined to see the mystery through to the end. Using a small saw, Silas sliced into the thin wood, careful not to damage whatever might lie beneath. It was the work of only a few minutes to sever the panel from the sides of the box. Brushing away the furious bees, Silas lifted the cut piece away to discover his prize. He stared in confusion at a golden lump that sat inside. It was a flattened spheroid, a little smaller than a bowling ball, with two deep, parallel indentations on one side. The queen bee rested in one of these, just as Adam had said. The structure appeared to be coated in crystallized honey, or perhaps made entirely of it. It was impossible to say. Eggs littered the floor, cascading down from the misshapen lump. Workers scrambled to carry them to safety, away from the sudden invasion of light. Silas lifted the heavy lump out of the bee box. It held fast to the floor for a moment before popping free in a crackle of broken honey crystals. The queen fluttered her wings, maintaining her balance, but did not move. She stared back at Silas as he turned the strange object around in his hands, puzzling over it. There were no wires or electronics at all. The only thing that the hidden compartment contained, aside from the golden lump, was the queen and her eggs, just as Adam had said. It made no sense. There had to be something more to it. Silas moved on to the next box, yanking the frames free and carving through the thin wood beneath. It pulled away to reveal the same thing, another mysterious spheroid glued to the bottom of the box by ancient honey. There were no connections, nothing to explain why the bees defended it or why Adam had hidden it. It was baffling. "Maybe these are too old," said Silas aloud. He looked up at the bees hurling themselves against his protective suit. "Is that it? Would a newer one be clearer?" He hurried to the end of the row where the newest hive sat, the one that had been isolated when he began work. The cloud of bees followed him, growing ever thicker in their desperate attempts to sting him. Silas swatted them aside and ripped the box open, cutting savagely into the secret compartment. He tore the wood free and tossed it aside, then froze as his gaze fell on what was inside. It was a lump, much the same shape as the others, but the crystalline coating of honey was much thinner, having not had years to form. The shape beneath was much more pronounced. It was the top half of a human head, severed at the jaw to make a flat base. Beneath the honey, hair still covered the head and mummified skin wrapped tightly over the skull. The eyes had been gouged out to provide a resting place for the queen. Through the unoccupied eye socket, Silas could see the wrinkled gray flesh of the brain. Larvae squirmed over it, their tiny bodies ticking daintily through its ridges. Eggs ran from the nasal cavity. They piled up against the teeth like terrible gelatinous pearls. Silas stepped back from the box in horror. His eyes swept across the hundreds upon hundreds of hives that made up Adam's apiary. It occurred to him, belatedly, that it was odd that Adam had no other permanent workers on his farm, no one who had come back from a previous year to assist with the new honey harvest. He had assumed, at the time, that it was simply due to the itinerant nature of such help. It was exactly the opposite, he realized now. It wasn't that they left too soon. None of them had ever left at all. There was a sound of metal shears snipping threateningly. Silas spun around to find Adam standing before him, far too close. The shears he held were as long as his arm, and he snipped them dangerously as he slowly advanced on Silas. Silas, in turn, backed cautiously down the lengthy row of hives, his hands held out in front of him. The swarming bees vanished, leaving the two men alone in an abruptly quiet field.
I won't tell anyone, Silas said to fill the silence.
The bees told me you were going to do this, Adam remarked. His voice was calm, conversational. I hoped they were wrong. Figured I'd give you the chance to prove it.
He snipped the shears again, forcing Silas to jump back.
Guess they know their business, though.
I'll leave, Silas pleaded. I'll be gone tomorrow. Today, you'll never see me again. You'll never hear anything about me. I promise.
Adam shrugged.
Here's the thing. It's not really up to me anymore. Once you violated the beehives, you made this between you and them. So I'm going to let them decide how this ends.
He opened the shears again. Silas again flinched away.
Keep those away from me. You can't let the bees at me.
I kind of think I can, said Adam.
The bees' buzz suddenly surged. To Silas's terror, he could feel them all over his body, climbing, swarming, and stinging. He slapped his hands behind him to find a large, raggedy hole directly up the back of his suit.
I got you with the very first cut, said Adam as Silas screamed and swatted futilely at himself. The rest of this was just waiting for them to gather.
Pain exploded from every part of Silas's body as he collapsed under 10,000 stings. As he writhed on the ground, he felt the drones beginning to dig at his eyes. Even with his tongue swollen and his mouth crawling with bees, he managed to choke out one more scream. Adam watched dispassionately until Silas's convulsions stopped. Only once the corpse was still did he leave to fetch the hacksaw and an empty beehive. By the time he returned, the bees had gone back to their normal routines. Adam sighed as he sawed through the tendons at the back of Silas's jaw. If he didn't find someone new soon, he'd be doing the fall harvest by himself.
Should I go introduce myself to that one, too?
Adam liked the look of his new hire. He was a sturdy and eager boy, but didn't seem overly ambitious. He'd probably make it for a while before starting to wonder about the hives. He shook his head in response to the teen's question.
Leave that one be. Once they're adjusted, I'll bring them over to join the rows. Don't worry about it until then.
Off in a distant corner of the field, Silas buzzed with fury, fighting off the crawling thoughts in his skull and the slow, calcifying honey. You've been listening to Beneath the Hives by Micah Edwards. Micah Edwards graduated from William & Mary with a degree in English and no particular plans to use it. He now finds himself occupying various roles as an author, a comedian, and a database administrator, depending on the day of the week. He resides in Richmond, Virginia, the world's premier home of authors named Micah Edwards. And now, to finish up tonight's episode, I present The Thing Living in Mr. Crabtree's Nose by Charles Williams. Dr. Aldo Ravelli had a genetic predisposition to substance abuse. That's how the scion of a prominent medical family was described in the polite society of San Francisco's historic Nob Hill neighborhood. In truth, he was a blackout drunk with a fondness for psilocybin mushrooms chased with a generous intake of nitrous oxide. In most families, this would have been viewed as a curse, but in Aldo's case, it was more like a rite of passage. His grandfather and father had been well-known surgeons in the Bay Area, and both had struggled with their own addictions at various times in their lives. Fortunately for them, they were able to cover up most of their indiscretions with the power and connections that only old money could provide. The two doctors had survived their personal scandals and thrived, even if some of their patients had not. Aldo had started drinking at the age of 12, discreetly emptying any wine glasses left by guests at his family's frequent dinner parties. By the time he had finished prep school, he was a functional alcoholic. Like his grandfather and father, he had been expected to join the family practice, but his personal weaknesses prompted a course change, and he navigated the less strenuous path of dental school rather than pursuing a medical career. The young doctor's undoing had been his passion for magic mushrooms taken with the handy supply of nitrous oxide that his dental practice afforded him. The laughing gas, mixed with psilocybin, would often produce an enhanced hallucinatory experience that carried him to a place where the pressures of familial expectations and disappointments no longer existed. One such escape resulted in Aldo waking up in the Japanese garden of Murphy's Landing Public Park, completely naked. Thank heavens the reach of wealth and privilege stretched from the Bay Area to the small central California town, which he had chosen for its anonymity and bucolic setting. Aldo pulled his black Mercedes-Maybach into the parking lot of the dental offices of Blackrock and Ravelli and eased his way into the space bearing his name. It had been 4 months since he had last parked in that space, and it felt good to be back. Before exiting the car, he bowed his head and recited the AA prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Before raising his head, he added, and if it's not too much trouble, keep me away from the shrooms and nitrous too. He took one more deep breath and got out of his car. He made his way unsteadily to the entrance of the gray office building. His prodigious use of nitrous had left him with a condition called myeloneuropathy, which manifested in simultaneous damage to the tracts of his spinal cord and the peripheral nerves in his lower limbs. He steadied himself as he pushed open the door.
Welcome back!
A throng of people dressed in black, green, and blue dental scrubs were standing behind the long front desk, shouting their greeting in unison. Aldo managed a weak smile and walked a gauntlet of overenthusiastic dental hygienists and dental assistants as they emerged from behind the desk to shake his hand and give him hugs.
How is your vacation, Dr. L? We've really missed you.
Mary Gonzalez, the primary dental aide whom Aldo often thought of as Lucrezia Borgia, disguised as Mother Teresa, squeezed his arm and walked with him to his office.
It was great, Mary. Just what the doctor, in this case me, ordered. Sometimes you just have to recharge the old batteries, right? And Venice is beautiful this time of year.
Well, it wasn't the same without you around here. I'm going to let Dr. Blackstone know you're in your office. He's with a patient, but he wanted to talk to you before you had your first appointment.
Mary left the room with the same irritating, bouncing gait she always seemed to maintain, regardless of the time of day. Aldo used the time to reacquaint himself with his workspace. On the wall opposite his large oak desk was a picture of his young son and daughter with his ex-wife and himself. The photograph whispered a memory of better times, before the people in it had become the casualties of his selfishness and overindulgence. On each side of this picture were the portraits of two stern-looking men dressed in white lab coats with stethoscopes draped around their necks. Here's to you, you nasty old turds. Dr. Richard Blackstone came through Aldo's door just as he finished saying the word turds.
Is that any way to greet your best friend and partner after 4 long months? Forgive me, buddy. I guess I should have just called you Dick, like most of the people who don't know your first name. It's nice to see that biting wit is still intact. So, is this where you give me the pep talk? Time to get back up on the horse? Everybody makes mistakes? Let's win one for the Gipper.
Aldo leaned forward in the squeaky office chair in anticipation of his friend's sarcastic comeback.
Actually, buddy, this is more like a come-to-Jesus moment. No 12-step pun intended.
Blackstone remained standing.
You and I both know that the dental profession is tough on its practitioners. the highest rate of suicide in any white-collar profession, rampant clinical depression, incredible pressure to treat people who don't want to be there, and performing procedures on one of the most delicate parts of the body. What I'm saying is, don't make the job any harder than it already is. Aldo shouldn't have been surprised by his partner's serious tone, but he was. This had been his third stint in rehab since the two dentists had combined their practices 10 years ago. He moved the chair back from the desk and stood up. Okay, I understand. 4 months in rehab does tend to make an impression, you know. That's what you said last time and the time before that. But I hope so, for your sake. Just to make sure, we're going to get you back up to speed gradually. Your first appointment is Mr. Virgil Crabtree, a Medicaid patient from the English Glen Memory Care Facility. He's 86 with a mouthful of rotten teeth and dementia. Blackstone handed Aldo the patient's folder and smiled. Oh, lucky me, the trifecta, Aldo sneered. Since when did we start seeing people with Medicaid? When the pandemic frightened off a substantial number of our patrons. Didn't you read your email in that country club you call a rehab center? The other dentist prodded. You'll love him. He's a real pussycat. We've already had him in the exam room for about an hour. Mary gave him a triazolam pill when he first got here, and with any luck, he'll sleep through the whole thing. No memory, no pain, no complaints, right? That's a bonus for your first time up to the plate in a while. The other thing that makes him a perfect patient for you is the amount of work you're going to have to do in this guy's mouth. Let's just say that dental hygiene has not been Mr. Crabtree's first priority for a few years. You're going to shake off a lot of orthodontic rust in that old man's mouth. Mary rapped sharply twice on the office door and poked her head in.
Excuse me, guys. I hate to interrupt two old college buddies reliving past glories, but Mr. Crabtree is out cold surrounded by a bunch of cotton rolls, and he's waiting for the prodigal dentist to shove them in his mouth.
Who could resist that invitation? I guess I'd better start performing some miracles, said Aldo. Do you remember the famous dentist and gunfighter Doc Holliday's dying words? They were, "Damn, this is funny," said Blackstone as he made a sweeping gesture with his right arm, directing Ravelli out of the office and following behind. Exam room 3 looked very much like every other exam room in the dental building of Blackstone and Ravelli. The walls were painted pale green and were adorned with several nondescript landscape prints. The back wall had a large bulletin board festooned with holiday greetings and family photos of patients who felt some sort of kinship with the men who penetrated their bodies in the most non-sexual of ways. The ceiling above the dental chair featured a happy face sticker, smiling at the person below. In this case, the smile was wasted on the ruddy-faced old man who lay snoring in the reclining black leather chair. Having already gloved and masked himself, Aldo entered the small room and found Mary, also gloved and masked, arranging the dental tray with two dental mirrors, a suction holder, and a metal periodontal probe. Mary, get those x-rays for me, please. He studied the pictures carefully. Well, it's not as bad as I thought. Mr. Crabtree has a lot of cavities for sure, but I don't see any teeth that need to be extracted, and there doesn't appear to be any sign of gum disease. He's going to need several visits to get everything done, though. I wouldn't put anyone through that much dental work in one appointment, let alone an elderly gentleman with dementia. We'll work on the 3 distal and 2 medial cavities on the upper left side today. Prepare the lidocaine shot for me, please. Holding the side of the old man's mouth open, Aldo gently applied the numbing agent to both sides of his patient's gums, inserting the thin needle above the yellowed teeth filled with dark spots of decay and slowly pushing the plunger. Let's give him about 10 minutes to let that shot take effect, Mary. I'll stay in here with him, and you can go ahead and check to see if Richard needs you for anything.
See you in about 10, then,
said Mary as she left the room and bounded down the hall. Aldo was relieved to be free of his assistant's judgmental scrutiny. It always seemed like she was enjoying some private joke at his expense,
and today he had the feeling part of her job was to watch him like a hawk. He settled into the chair at the side counter, which also served as a desk. He rifled through the folders to see what other dental wonders the day would hold for him. Then, he heard the noise. The silence in the exam room disclosed even the faintest of sounds. The noise was an odd mix between spitting and static, like the barely audible whistle of a tiny tea kettle. The dentist turned around to see where it might be coming from. Perhaps Mary had forgotten to turn some of the equipment off, though that seemed unlikely. He realized that the noise he heard seemed to be coming from the old man laying comatose in the dental chair. "Mr. Crabtree, what's going on with you?" Aldo's rhetorical question fell on deaf ears as he carefully examined the old man's mouth for signs of breathing distress. The sound had lessened as he stood directly above the head of his elderly patient, but was still disquietingly present. Dr. Ravelli turned his attention to Mr. Crabtree's nose, making sure that no mucus was blocking his nostrils, and that was when he saw the thing. It looked like a small, flesh-colored worm wiggling just below the opening of the old man's right nares. It shimmied almost to the top, shining with the viscid secretion acquired during its trip through the nasal passage, and then quickly disappeared back from view. Aldo stepped back, feeling a mixture of fascination and revulsion. "What the hell?" he said to no one who could hear. He leaned back gingerly over Mr. Crabtree's nose. After a decade of dental practice, Ravelli was used to seeing some pretty gross stuff in his patients' noses, but he had never seen anything like this. Once again, the tiny thing in Mr. Crabtree's nose squirmed to the top of his nostril, emitting a moist, whistling sound that grew louder as it struggled through the narrow passageway. Seemingly emboldened by its progress, the worm-like creature reached the edge of the old man's nostril and turned as if exploring its surroundings. As it rotated slowly in his direction, Dr. Aldo Ravelli found himself staring into a tiny human face. Its eyes were mere slits, but its nose and mouth had a distinct human form. The thing's miniature mouth opened and closed with a nauseating rhythm, continuing to produce the maddening burble. "Oh my God!" Aldo staggered back, the weakness in his legs causing him to stumble and upset the dental tray, sending the sterilized instruments crashing to the floor. Mary came rushing into exam room 3 in response to the noise.
"Are you all right, Dr. Ravelli? What happened?"
"Mary, would you please have a look at Mr. Crabtree's nose for me? The right nostril. Make sure it's clear." Aldo had regained some of his composure and quickly realized that having a dentist with a history of abusing hallucinogens claim to see a worm with a human face in the nose of his first patient might not be a good way to start this conversation.
"It looks fine, Dr. L. No obstructions. What did you think you saw?"
Mary's question hung in the air as Aldo judiciously considered his response. What had he seen? Some kind of parasite? An insect that had taken advantage of Mr. Crabtree's limited awareness? He'd heard of cockroaches crawling into people's ears. Or was he hallucinating? Was he having some sort of flashback brought on from his sessions of laughing gas mixed with magic mushrooms? No parasite or insect he was aware of mimicked the characteristics of a human face. "I thought I saw some mucus inside his right nostril. If you didn't see it, he probably sniffed it back up into his sinus. I guess I haven't built up my snot tolerance to pre-vacation levels yet. Sorry about the tray."
"No worries. Give me a second, I'll grab some clean instruments and reset the tray."
Mary picked up the dental tools scattered on the floor and left the dentist alone again with his patient. She glanced over her left shoulder as she left the room, giving Aldo what he perceived to be a dubious look. Aldo moved slowly back to his original position beside the dental chair. he grabbed a dental mirror with an LED light that had not been among the dropped instruments and angled it above the old man's nostril. The whistling sound began again, growing with minor intensity as the thing squirmed and struggled at the bottom of the nasal passage. Dr. Ravelli stood transfixed as the thing in Mr. Crabtree's nose fought its way to the opening. As if in response to the light, the tiny eye slits quivered and opened. Two minute gray eyes, like those of a premature baby, peered up at the dentist. This time, Aldo did not let his sense of disgust dictate his actions. He remained still and studied the strange creature in front of him. He recalled that his father had once published a lengthy article in a medical journal on the subject of parasitic twins. This occurred when a twin embryo developing in utero does not fully separate. One of the embryos develops at the expense of the other. This process may produce conjoined or vanishing twins, but a parasitic twin is vestigial to its healthy, fully formed twin. It becomes completely dependent on the body functions of its sibling, called the autosite. Since the condition only occurs in approximately 1 in 11 million births, the research is mostly sketchy. Could that be what Aldo was observing now? Could this be a vestigial twin that had somehow survived for 86 years within the body of Virgil Crabtree?
Hey buddy, how you doing? Mary said you might be showing some nerves about being back in the saddle.
Aldo turned his head reflexively in response to Dr. Richard Blackstone's entrance into the exam room. When he turned back to Mr. Crabtree, the thing was gone.
Yeah, I guess I'm a little more anxious than I thought I would be. I'll be okay, though. Just a normal case of butterflies.
Ravelli had no intention of telling his friend he thought that there was a parasitic twin living in Mr. Crabtree's nose. At least, not until he was 100% sure that what he was seeing was real and not some leftover mental baggage from a bad nitrous and mushroom trip.
Well, I'm just in the next room if you need me. Remember, you got this.
Thanks. I appreciate the support more than you know. Aldo's legs began to shake almost imperceptibly. Mary returned to the exam room with a new tray of instruments and without acknowledging that she had informed Dr. Blackstone that Aldo seemed a little shaky on his first day back. Lucrezia was always looking for an opportunity to parcel out her poison.
Let's get started, and maybe you could step back a little further. You're in my light.
The dentist said the words with an irritability which literally and figuratively put his aid in her place.
Of course, Dr. Ravelli.
It seemed the balance of power had been temporarily restored. The dentist took the turbine-powered handpiece and began to drill on the number 5 bicuspid. Mary repositioned herself at his side with the wet vacuum pump. Aldo focused on the huge cavity in the tooth, but, out of the corner of his eye, caught the movement of the small creature as it journeyed to the top of the old man's nostril once more.
Did you see that, Mary?
Aldo jerked his head toward his dental assistant.
Did you see that thing wiggling to get out of Mr. Crabtree's nose?
He started to feel beads of sweat dampen his forehead.
Where, doctor? What did you see?
In his right nostril, damn it! Something's alive in there, I tell you!
Mary leaned forward to examine the right side of the elderly man's nose.
I'm sorry, Dr. Al, but I can't see anything.
Aldo turned back to his patient. The thing in Mr. Crabtree's nose had once again slipped back into the moist darkness of the nasal passage.
There was something in there, I'm sure of it.
Dr. Ravelli felt his tenuous foothold on the bridge back to normality starting to slip.
Let me look again.
Mary took the metal mirror and used its light to examine both of the old man's nostrils.
I still can't see anything out of the ordinary. Why don't I just go ask Dr. Blackstone if he can step in for a minute and have a look? Maybe he'll be able to find it.
Don't you dare patronize me, you bitch! You think I'm using again, don't you? Oh, I'm aware that nobody but Blackstone is supposed to know where I've really been for the past 4 months, but you've heard the gossip, haven't you, Mary? There's nothing that happens in this office that gets by you, is there? You know where all the bodies are buried.
Dr. Ravelli, I really don't know what you're talking about, and you're starting to make me feel very uncomfortable.
The dental assistant started to back away slowly from her stance beside the dentist. The high-speed drill in his hand suddenly seemed more like a weapon than a healing tool.
I think Dr. Blackstone needs to be in here right now, and I'm going to go get him.
Mary sprinted, rather than bounced, out of the exam room's door. Aldo, still holding the drill in his right hand, began to pinch and prod Mr. Crabtree's pliant nose using his left thumb and index finger with frenzied interest. With the silence of the exam room returning, he could hear the faint cacophony of the thing's wet movements and the staticky whistling of its minuscule maw. Cautiously, the thing made its way up the short passage again, but this time it slithered slightly beyond the opening of the nostril. It left a green trail of snot on the top of the old man's nose and revealed a vessel of connective tissue that looked like a miniature umbilical cord behind its tube-shaped body.
"I've got you now, you little bastard!"
Aldo shouted. He slowly moved his left hand to snatch the creature from Mr. Crabtree's nose.
"What in the world's going on in here?"
Dr. Richard Blackstone demanded as he and Mary rushed into the room, and Aldo began to reach for the thing.
"I'll show you what. Both of you, look at this aberration!"
Aldo gestured toward his elderly patient.
"There's nothing there, Aldo. Look! Nothing but an old man with some snot on his nose.
I think you've tried to come back too soon, my friend. Now, take some deep breaths, put the handpiece down, and I'll take care of Mr. Crabtree. Mary will walk with you back to your office, and we'll talk about this when you've calmed down a little."
Once again, Aldo's tiny tormentor had managed to retreat inside the shadowy recesses of the old man's nares without being detected by anyone else.
"No, no, not this time, you little freak!"
Aldo turned on the high-speed drill and plunged it into Mr. Crabtree's right nostril. He turned and twisted it as it sank deeper and deeper into the old man's nasal passage, its high-pitched whir muffled as it tore through cartilage and dug into his sinus cavity. Blood filled the nostril and began to stream down the elderly patient's throat. He began to cough and gag convulsively as his bleary, bulging eyes popped open as if awakening from some horrific nightmare. Blackstone and the dental assistant lunged at Ravelli in a united effort to stop the carnage, but were momentarily held at bay by the other dentist's defensive movement of the patient's swivel chair. Other assistants and hygienists quickly filled the room to help prevent Aldo from inflicting any more damage. The same hands that only an hour before had hugged and welcomed him back now took him to the floor and held him in restraint. Torn apart from its host by the air turbine drill of Dr. Aldo Ravelli, the bloodied, parasitic twin of Virgil Crabtree dropped unseen from its brother's nostril and onto the pale blue linoleum floor of Exam Room 3. Mary, the dental assistant who knew where all the bodies were located in the dental offices of Blackstone and Ravelli, save for the tiny one writhing beneath her, took a backward step from the chaotic scene unfolding before her and stepped heavily on the thing that lived in Mr. Crabtree's nose. It crunched underneath her heel, its minuscule head popping like a ripe grape. Mary lifted her shoe to inspect the insignificant, viscous puddle of tissue, blood, and mucus, now blending into the sanguinary linoleum beneath the old man's dental chair. From its position on the ceiling above Exam Room 3, the yellow happy face sticker smiled benignly at the chaos below.
You
You've just heard The Thing Living in Mr. Crabtree's Nose by Charles Williams. Well, listeners, I'm afraid that concludes tonight's stories. We had quite the mucus-filled evening, didn't we? Honey and phlegm, both with fun little creatures crawling around in it. I can practically feel my sinuses cringing. In any event, thank you all for joining me this evening. Special thanks go out to Micah Edwards and Charles Williams for their wonderful stories, and to Rissa Montañez for her excellent voice work. Of course, I'll be back next week with more stories to chill your bones, and I hope to see you there. That's right, you. Until then, friends, stay spooky. You've been listening to the Horror Hill Podcast, a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights. Tonight's episode was hosted and narrated by yours truly, Eric Peabody. Original music provided by Eric Peabody and Nikki McSorley. Finalization by Eric Peabody and Craig Groshek. Got a terrifying tale of your own that you'd like performed? Email it to us at natalie@chillingtalesfordarknights.com to have your work considered for future production. Seeing as how we're all living in a technological nightmare of our own devising, I'll ask you to follow Chilling Tales for Dark Nights on social media and upvote, subscribe, and hit the bell notification icon if you're listening to this on YouTube. Not only will you have appeased the dark gods of cyberspace, but you'll be kept in the loop as we prepare more terrifying content. If you'd like access to uninterrupted horror, free of ads and these annoying bookend segments, might I recommend becoming a patron? You'll get access to hundreds of episodes of this show, as well as everything from the other programs in the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights cabal. That means all of Otis Gyre's Scary Stories Told in the Dark, Drew Blood's Dark Tales, Paul J. McSorley's Fear from the Heartland, and more. It's a veritable smorgasbord of horrific delights. As for me personally, I'm on most social media as Viking Guitar or Viking Guitar Productions. I'm always on the lookout for new stories to narrate and new music projects to mix or master. If that's of interest to you, feel free to reach out and we can talk turkey. Also, I will be back next week with more terrifying tales to keep you up all night. If darkness is what you're after, listener, your search is over. Yet, let it be known, you haven't found the darkness. The darkness has found you.